Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. International condemnation of the military takeover in Sudan continues.
It is still very difficult for people to access the downtown where the government institutions are because there are heavy deployment of military along the road.
Voluntary repatriation of refugees to the Central African Republic from Democratic Republic of Congo resumes. A new report urges Africa to adapt to climate change effects. We'll discuss human rights abuses in Mali. Rights groups say abuses in the Sahel region are down. And the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations visits Niamey, Niger.
We had an excellent meeting with the president. It was about an hour-long meeting with the entire Security Council. We discussed the full range of issues, including his assessment of the security concerns here.
And Zimbabweans are divided over Western sanctions. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, Sweden, the United Kingdom, United States, the European Union, and the United Nations, as members of the Friends of Sudan group, have strongly condemned the ongoing military takeover in Sudan. In a statement on Wednesday, the group called for the immediate release of Sudanese officials who they say have been unlawfully detained. The group also called for the restoration of all transitional arrangements and institutions as defined in the constitutional document. Meanwhile, the African Union suspended Sudan on Wednesday until civilian rule is restored. The AU described the military takeover as an unconstitutional seizure of power. Also, the World Bank Wednesday suspended Sudan. Journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital Khartoum says it is still difficult for citizens to move around in the capital due to heavy security deployment.
Sudanese are still waiting for the commander-in-chief of the Sudan's army, General Al-Burhan. He actually promised during a press conference that he was going to establish a sovereign council and a cabinet, as well as the judicial council. So people are still waiting to see if actually he's going to do so. He told the press conference that these individuals are going to be purely civilians. According to him, many Sudanese are regarding this as a complete coup, but for him, no. He said this is not a coup because the military is not going to take any power from any civilian. He is going to appoint civilians into these positions as required by the constitutional document. But generally speaking, political parties and revolutionaries, many are still upset with what had happened. In residential areas or neighborhoods, there are still young people gathering, burning tires and singing slogans, calling to the end of the military rule and going back to civilians, slogans that call for peace, freedom and justice, the three slogans of the revolution. It is still very difficult for people to access the downtown where the government institutions are because there are heavy deployment of military along the road. Some bridges linking Khartoum to Omdurman and Khartoum North are still locked because they don't allow people to cross the bridge from either town to another.
Michael, people in Khartoum or over Sudan, how are they getting their information? Is the national television and radio open?
The national television is on, but it's only broadcast few items and they just play songs. Majority of them depend on other international media such as Al Jazeera, such as some other Middle East channels. The internet service is still shut down. And even the phone services are operating at half capacity or even a 30% of the capacity of the phone services. It is very difficult for people to communicate.
The airport in Khartoum, is it still closed?
Yes. Up to now, the airport was announced that it's supposed to open yesterday around 4 evening. And I believe this morning we expect some flights to take off from Khartoum Airport or even to arrive Khartoum Airport.
Michael, you were talking about a planned protest sometime this weekend. Who is planning this protest? Is that permissible?
They call themselves Forces for Freedom and Change. This is a coalition of more than 20 political parties who actually initiated and signed a declaration that actually led to the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. They regard this as a complete coup that has actually overtaken civilian rule of the Sudan Transitional Government.
You mentioned Michael, former Prime Minister Hamdok. We hear that he has been released. What is his situation now?
He has been released. Al-Burhan mentioned during the press conference that he actually kept Hamdok in his house just for his safety, and he doesn't want any harm to happen to him because he regarded him as one of the Sudanese icons that has been serving this transitional period for the last 2 years with the patriotic spirit, and he doesn't want anything to happen to him. So up to now, Hamdok did not make any statement. He did not speak to the media. So we don't know whether this is his own decision not to speak to the media, or he might have been instructed by the military leaders at this moment not to speak to the media and not even to address the Sudanese people.
Michael, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Our journalist Michael Atit is speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, has visited the Niamey 1 vaccination clinic in Niamey, capital of Niger, where she thanked public health workers and saw some of the 302,400 COVID-19 vaccines that the United States has provided to Niger through COVAX being administered. Ambassador Thomas Greenfield also observed how the U.S. government is supporting the Niger Ministry of Public Health's work to ensure Niger can safely and effectively distribute vaccine to its citizens.
We had an excellent meeting with the president. It was about an hour-long meeting with the entire Security Council. We discussed the full range of issues, including his assessment of the security concerns here and what is required to address those concerns. We discussed with him the transition and what plans are being made to move forward on the election. And we had a full discussion on the role of MINUSMA and their assessment of what will be needed in a future MINUSMA resolution. It's actually a total of 200,000 plus vaccines. The second shipment, I'm not sure if it's arrived yet, but it's on the way. It arrived yesterday. And we are very, very proud that we were able to make this contribution to the people of Mali. And we look forward to further engagements. We've given close to over $30 million in the health sector to Mali to address the broad range of health issues. And the U.S. is Mali's largest humanitarian donor across the board. And I was able to share with the president our strong commitment and friendship with Mali as we move forward and our plans to continue to engage the country as it addresses the reforms and the transition process. We are still expecting that the government will move forward on the election. We have not been told that there are any plans for an extension, but we did, as the Security Council, ask for their plans moving forward. We would like to see timelines and benchmarks.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, speaking in Niamey, Niger. The Malian transitional government earlier this week expelled the envoy of the Economic Community of West African States amid tensions with other international actors when it comes to the transitional government honoring its commitment to hold elections in February next year. Corinne Dufka, Sahel Director for Human Rights Watch, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the transitional government regarding human rights elections and more.
There aren't a lot of details about the specifics which led to the expulsion of the CEDEAO or ECOWAS representative, but there are some reports that suggest that he might have been speaking with the press and civil society, which angered the government. The government is very defensive about the fact that they seem to be hedging on their previous promise to hold elections by February 2022. They are now calling for what they call an assise nationale, or a national consultation, in which the government, which will meet with civil society, political parties, and other groups to decide the timeline for the elections. This has worried the international community, including the regional body ECOWAS and diplomatic missions and the United Nations Security Council, because they fear that it will prolong the military government and could ultimately lead to them remaining in place.
Human Rights Watch had a report out about disappearances and executions by security forces. So how is the transitional government faring in regards to human rights?
It's difficult to say whether those abuses are trending up or down. Honestly, we and other organizations, including the United Nations, have documented a steady stream of allegations against the security forces perpetrated during counterterrorism operations. That includes disappearances, arbitrary detentions, and executions. There were some committed during the previous regime of President Keita, as well as during the last transitional government and during this transitional government. We have seen an increase in incommunicado detentions by this government of those who appear to have been close to the previous transitional government. That is worrying. That's a bit of concern. We documented three of those cases, but we believe there are more.
There was a visit from the UN Security Council in Mali this past weekend. What kind, or if any, kind of results or resolution or, you know, announcements were made during that visit?
Well, I think the transitional government dug their heels in, despite the pressure from the UN Security Council, which was in the interest of pushing them to hold elections in February of next year. They said that the timeline would not be determined until December of this year, after this consultative process with political parties and civil society. I would imagine the UN Security Council was disappointed that the government refused to adhere to or commit to the February timeline for elections.
What is the reason the government is giving for not sticking to, or possibly not sticking to, the February election timeline?
The transitional government insists on consulting more widely with political parties and civil society with respect to the timeline. They have not met crucial deadlines which were needed to ensure that preparations would be in place for the February election, so it is looking quite unlikely. But of course, this isn't the first time that transitional governments have reneged on some of their commitments, and I think the concern is that the government, which, you know, has not been duly elected, will endure for longer periods of time, and that just undermines, you know, democracy and rule of law.
That was Corinne Dufka, Sahel Director for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, there were reports Wednesday that the Malian authorities had arrested Kawu Njiam, vice president of Mali's interim parliament, for making what the authorities called subversive remarks. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 28. Once commonplace, abuses by state security forces against civilians in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger have dropped sharply in the previous year, according to rights groups and data analysis by VOA. Reporting from Burkina Faso, where there has been the biggest drop of 77%, Henry Wilkins discovers what's behind the fall and what lessons can be learned.
Bubaka, whose name has been changed to protect his identity, says last year unidentified gunmen came to his home at night, shot and wounded his wife and son, then killed his brother. The next day, on doctor's orders, he travelled to the capital, Ouagadougou, for medical treatment to save his son's injured hand from amputation. While he was away, he says Burkinabe security forces kidnapped two of his brothers.
Biscuit.
Of course, he says, we cannot say that those who knocked on the door that night were from the military, but neighbours told me those who took my brothers away were. From that day until today, we've not heard from them. Are they alive or were they killed? Nobody knows, he added. Abuses by security forces in the Sahel conflict, where Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger battle terror groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, were extremely common. Last year, the number of civilian fatalities caused by the security forces was approaching those caused by terror groups. Data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED, shows the number of civilian fatalities caused by security forces have fallen dramatically in the last year to October 1st, compared with the previous year. They've dropped by 77% in Burkina Faso, 74% in Mali, and 65% in Niger. Rights groups say they've also observed the change and suggest why it might have occurred. Karine Dufka is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch.
We believe that there's a combination of factors. The first has been reporting by human rights groups, by journalists, as well as pressure from the international community.
Analysts say there could be other factors at play, including the outsourcing of military activities to government-backed militias, among other things. Andrew Leibovich is with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Over this period, the security situation in the Sahel has continued to get worse. And so I think one other possible explanation is that regional security forces are doing somewhat less patrolling, actually doing somewhat less, doing somewhat fewer operations where they're actually interacting with populations in rural areas, especially.
The Burkinabe army says accusations of abuse by security forces have not been proven. In a statement to VOA, it said respect for human rights is a major concern for the National Armed Forces and is part of the basic education for soldiers. But the consequences of the atrocities are not going away, says Dufka.
Bad news is there has not been, there have not been investigations, much less justice and accountability.
Boubacar says trying to seek justice from the same authorities he believes committed crimes would be pointless. He says he can't see how there would be a positive outcome, even if he went to court. So he decided to let matters lie. But he still wants to know what happened to his two brothers. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says it has restarted a voluntary repatriation operation for thousands of refugees from the Central African Republic who were living in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Over the past 2 years, the UN Refugee Agency has helped more than 5,000 refugees return from Congo to the Central African Republic. The voluntary operation, which has been interrupted on two occasions, resumed on Friday. The program was first halted in March 2020, when both countries closed their borders to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The second interruption occurred last December, when violence surrounding the CAR presidential elections sent an estimated 92,000 refugees fleeing into the DRC. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says a first group of 250 refugees left Mole Camp to Zongo City in the northwestern DRC last Friday. She says a second group of 250 people left the camp on Tuesday morning. Later in the day, she says a 20-minute boat ride will ferry the refugees across the Ubangi River to Bangui, the CAR capital.
People are only returning to areas where security has improved in the past 6 months, such as Bangui and the prefectures of Mbele, Mpoko and Lobai. Most of those set to return fled their homes because of violence in 2013. UNHCR and partners will soon organise voluntary repatriation flights for refugees living in Inke Camp in north of Bangui province, and air transport is necessary due to the distances and poor roads.
The voluntary repatriation began in November 2019. That followed the signing of a tripartite agreement between the CAR and DRC in July. Mantu says nearly 10,000 refugees in three camps hosting them have signed up for voluntary repatriation. Since violence between armed groups erupted in 2013, more than 680,000 refugees and asylum seekers have fled to Cameroon, the DRC, the Republic of the Congo, and Chad. About a third are being hosted in DRC. Another 630,000 people are displaced within Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabweans say sanctions imposed in 2003 and earlier by the United States and other Western nations because of election rigging and human rights abuses are derailing the country's economic recovery. The sanctions are a divisive issue among Zimbabweans. As Columbus Mavunga reports for VOA from Harare, the UN Special Rapporteur has been assessing the sanctions' impact.
That 8-year-old Wengesai Imbayago is among those who have camped outside the U.S. Embassy in Harare in protests that have lasted nearly 3 years. He says he wants UN officials to take action now. Imbayabo says the protesters' aim is to leave the place outside the U.S. Embassy where they are camped out when the United States removes sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe. The sanctions, he says, have strained relations of the country with other countries worldwide. The Labour, Economist and African Democrats of Zimbabwe, an opposition political party, was one of the organizations that were initially supporting sanctions which targeted specific individuals and entities linked to the abuses. But now its leader, Linda Tsungirai Masarira, says sanctions are hurting ordinary Zimbabweans and must be removed.
Because if indeed these sanctions were targeted, they missed the target. Because the 83 people they break that are on the sanctions are living lavish lifestyles. They send their children to school in the diaspora. They go to the hospital anywhere in the world. They've got private jets. They are not affected anyhow by these sanctions.
But not every Zimbabwean agrees. One of them is Pride Mukono, an opposition activist. The issue of sanctions has been topical this week, with the government calling for their removal, Mukono says. But the reasons behind the sanctions are still in place, including violence, rigging elections, corruption, and mismanagement of resources, he says. Mukono argues as long as the reasons are in place, the sanctions must not be removed and those on the sanctions list must not travel to the West. United States, Britain and the European Union in statements this week said Zimbabwe's economy was suffering not because of sanctions, but because of corruption and government mismanagement of the country's resources. Still, Bishop Eric Ruona, vice president of Zimbabwe Council of Churches, the country's faith-based coalition, says it is time for sanctions to be removed.
But we are also saying the issues that have resulted in these sanctions being imposed must be also be addressed. All the issues being the human rights violations, our economy, our humanitarian situation.
Alena Dohan, a UN special rapporteur, has spent 2 weeks in Zimbabwe assessing the impact of the sanctions. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government has led the calls for protest, alleging Zimbabwe is being punished for the land reform program under the late President Robert Mugabe, which displaced white commercial farmers. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The Global Center on Adaptation says climate change will push 120 million people into extreme poverty by 2030, and a third of them will be Africans if nothing is done to mitigate its effects. The findings are the center's report on Africa, released on Tuesday this week. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking in Nairobi at the release of a report looking at present-day and future climate change risks in Africa, the head of the Global Center on Adaptation, Patrick Vauken, says the climate crisis may create millions of poor people on the continent.
In fact, worldwide, climate change, if unchecked, will push 122 million new people into extreme poverty by 2030. Of these, in sub-Saharan Africa alone, 43 million new poor people pushed into poverty by climate change. And even if development is rapid and inclusive, up to 12 million people in Africa could be pushed into poverty in this time due to climate change alone.
The Netherlands-based organization that works on climate adaptation solutions around the globe said Africa's failure to adapt to the recurrent climate shocks will also increase the cost of borrowing, reducing investment opportunities for its people. According to the Africa Development Bank, AFDB, the continent needs $7 to $15 billion a year to create adaptation programs. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, addressing the gathering online, said his government is ready to handle the adverse effect of climate change. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.